That's it. No other direction. But you saying you want to put your headphones on?
Sure.
That wait, Josh, they stopped during the production to do the things, or like on the final product, they edited it all in.
Oh, they edited it in.
Okay.
So yeah.
Edited.
Yeah, they did that. When I went back and listened to it, like it came out like a month later, and all the plugs for mattresses.
Oh, Casper? Or was it like Serta?
Yeah, I think it was like, it was some, yeah, it was yeah.
Are your mattresses free? Oh, you don't, that's a cultural reference you made.
No, it was some mattress brand we don't have. So it was probably Casper.
Maybe. Casper's the new, never mind. Yeah. I'll explain it to you later. You ready? Hey, everybody. Welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. I'm going to turn myself down. I like startled myself. In case you're tuning in for the first time ever, this is Innovation Crush. We cover all things. Let me start over. That's weird. Are you good in your headphones? I am good. I was just like, it was extremely loud.
Yeah, I'm good. One side.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. It's me, Chris Denson, your gracious host. And today we have a really amazing guest by the name of AJ Burton Shaw. Say hello, AJ.
Hello, AJ.
Hello, AJ. Man, that is good. That's good humor there. This is gonna be great. Are you allowed to say what AJ stands for?
Am I allowed to?
Yes. Some people are like, oh, he's tops out. If I tell you, I got to kill you.
Who cares? I'm gonna tell. Yeah, no, yeah. If I tell you,
and you will kill me. I will tell you, and I will. This will be the first death on this podcast, by the way.
Yeah. No. Look, my name is the same as my dad's name, so we just went with AJ.
See, my name is the same as my mom's name, which is even more embarrassing. People call the house and be like, "Can I speak to Chris?" I'm like, "Hey," and they'd be like, "No, not you." So that was embarrassing. But give us a little bit of the 101, maybe the 90-second version on who AJ Burton Shaw is. Professionally speaking, personally speaking, I don't know how.
Yeah, right? Sure. Well, so I'm the founder and CEO of Serato, which I founded with my business partner Steve West back in 1998. Yeah, in Auckland, New Zealand. So I'm from New Zealand, born and raised. Actually, moved around a little bit when I was quite young. Lived in South Africa for a couple of years and Australia for a year. And settled in Auckland, New Zealand.
Your accent's all over the place there.
Yeah,
they're all kind of similar, but not similar at all.
Yeah. Well, when I arrived in New Zealand, the South African accent was something I had to get rid of pretty quickly.
Did you see the movie Chappie, by the way?
Oh yeah, I loved it.
I haven't seen it, so
A good film.
Reference over. So this is cool. What was going on in New Zealand that, you know, because you don't think Serato New Zealand, especially as popularized as Serato is here, as a cultural icon, I think, in terms of music and technology.
Yeah, yeah. Serato's actually just starting to catch on in New Zealand now, so that's good.
That's ironic.
Yeah. Our market's always been the US, actually. A lot of people who work at Serato in Auckland, you would think that they could say, "Hey, I work for Serato," and they'd be like, "Oh, wow, no!" But actually, they're like, "Oh, cool. What do they do?"
Yeah. So, well, even like I saw in some my research team was like Serato Audio Research, right? Is that still the name of the company, or like what was happening at that point in time under that moniker versus now?
Right. Well, when we formed the company, it's actually nothing to do with DJ. My business partner Steve and I both went to Auckland University and studied a computer science degree, and we used to kind of show each other different little projects that we were working on, mostly graphical things, actually, not a lot of audio. But there was this one thing that he was working on, and that was the ability to stretch sound, you know, slow it down and speed it up without changing its pitch. And he was interested in that because he was a bass player and he wanted to be able to take a CD and slow it down to half speed so he could figure out the licks. And he cracked it while we were still at university. And I said to him, "That's really cool. Let's start a company and see if we can sell this tech to somebody.
So basically, he took his work and blew it up.
Yeah, well, he
I like that. Let's make some money off of it.
Well, he wanted to give it away, so I said, let's not do that. Let's do this. And it was going to be, we thought it would be like in CD players and hardware and that kind of stuff. We ended up, after a little while, figuring out studio recording software is right. Where it belonged. And so we made this plugin called Pitch and Time.
How does a young AJ and young Steve, you know, what are those first steps that you make, especially like, you know, kind of pre social media and like getting the word out, like, and you're in New Zealand, you know, you're like, hey, we got this thing. Like whose door were you knocking on to?
Well, that's the thing is that because we thought hardware, we went to Japan and like started knocking on doors like, you know, Panasonic and Pioneer and people making basically CD and DVD players. And didn't get much interest. We went to America. We showed a few people. And it was actually a guy who was a studio engineer who saw our demo and said, oh, wow, I really need that for Pro Tools.
Hmm.
We said, oh, cool, what's that? And he said, okay, well, let me tell you about that. So then we went.
So
and,
green.
Yeah. We visited the DigiDesign, the makers of Pro Tools at the time, and before they merged with Avid. And showed them this thing, and they were super excited. And so, like, you know, your question is, how do you get it out there before social media? We took it to a thing called the Audio Engineers Society Conference in New York City. And AES is held once a year, and it alternates coasts. And we kind of had a little sub-booth with DigiDesign.
Right.
And, you know, we were blasting Money for Nothing and changing the pitch of the guitar solo at the beginning and the speed of the guitar solo at the beginning. And people would stop in their tracks and they turn around and they go, what is that?
Yeah. Cause I mean, at that point in time, like nobody had probably, I mean, there's pitch control on like a Korg keyboard, but not like to the extent.
No,
that
taking recorded audio and changing its speed without, you know, distorting it.
Right.
Was just something people hadn't heard before. So they would walk up to us and they want to know what it was. And then, you know, we went back to New Zealand. This show was in October, and we started getting phone calls and emails and this kind of thing. Of they wanted the dealers who sell, you know, musical and software wanted to get it from us, and we hadn't finished it yet. So we had to spend the next 2 months like really finishing it off, and then I had to build a sales database, and we, you know, it was just two guys.
This is very like HBO Silicon Valley kind of, you know, dude, it's like, you do want it? Like, then maybe we should, you know, I guess, you know, it sounds like in this story, Steve sort of the creative mind, and then you like you come in as the business end of the deal?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of overlap between the two of us. We got a lot in common, and we're both like huge math geeks and computer
science.
Not meth
geeks, guys. It was
no, not math geeks. Very, very different.
we should get some meth geeks on the show. That would be a fun episode.
I don't think I've heard of that before. I would like to see it. so there's a lot of overlap between us. But, you know, he's kind of like the backroom inventor kind of personality, and I'm the out there kind of meeting people personality, so it worked really well.
Because you got good hair, that's the thing.
The
guy in front needs to have the good hair. The other one can be like the mad scientist type.
Yeah. Well, you know, you got to have at least one of you who likes to talk to people. And, that was me.
So, this has been your career. I mean, this has been the thing, and I've uncovered some other things we'll get into later. But, you know, I can't do math, but was this 25, 30, 17 years? Where are we in your journey?
Oh, right. 1998. Serato, 18 years?
Yes. All right. See, I know math a little bit. I'm also a math geek. So for the past 18 years, this has been your thing. Like when did it actually pivot to the hands of the DJ?
Cool. Well, so we did that for a little while, did studio software. We came up with a couple of other plugins as well. And it would have been right around 2002 that I was kind of bored one weekend, and I've been listening to something with Chad, some DJ scratching on it.
Right.
And I was like, oh, that's I really like that sound. I want to be able to do that. But I didn't have turntables, didn't have records, didn't have access to any of it. So I did what a computer geek does. I wrote a piece of software that would simulate being able to scratch.
That's awesome.
And so I whipped it up over the weekend and took it into the office. And it was, you used the mouse. You know, there was a record that was turning on the screen. You would pick the mouse up
right.
and it would scratch. And we thought it would be an interesting toy. And we thought maybe we could sell it for like $50. But it wasn't until we had the idea of, well, why don't we attach like an MP3 player and some turntables and... Yeah, they'll be a real product. So that actually, we showed that for the first time. Well, in 2003, we went to the NAMM show with like a prototype, which was done as a plugin. And then in 2004, we showed Scratch Live. So that's when it was first seen by the public.
That's pretty amazing. And then, you know, because I imagine we talked about this earlier, but kind of like this theme of disrupting an industry, right? Like something as far as up until then, DJing was a very, very much a purist sport, right? And vinyl, maybe CDs were still kind of like frowned upon a little bit. But the vinyl enthusiast was like, no, man, don't mess with my vinyl. But, you know, and I want to put this in perspective for the audience. You know, what is the adoption rate of Serato to date?
You mean how many people?
Yeah, how many people are using it? Like,
well, I mean, it's difficult because we give the software away for free, you know, download it on the website and then you just got to buy the hardware. There's a lot of different hardware manufacturers that we've worked with over the year. But if you if you go by how many people have registered themselves on the Serato.com website as a, you know, as a customer, it's around it's a couple million.
I mean, that's
since
a,
you know,
it's a pretty big,
it's a lot of DJs, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's those are the only ones that registered. So you know, you think about that. I guess when did you realize it caught on? Because you know, and more importantly, I guess what was that conversion mechanism? Because I think you had to play a little bit of I need to convince this audience and this, you know, this community that this is a better tool than what they've already been using.
Yeah, well, back then there was another player in the market, if you remember, but Stanton had a piece of software called Vinyl Scratch, and they had a little thing called the Scratch Amp. And so, you know, at the beginning, it was us, little tiny company in New Zealand, and Stanton Magnetics, which had a very similar product. And they were doing a lot of marketing, and they were spending a lot of money, you know, pushing their product, and we didn't really have the budget for that. So it was definitely word of mouth for us. And we had like an online forum, which was... You know, I mean, this is before social media again, so it was like, you know, we built it.
Right.
And we made it so anyone could write to us and to each other. And, you know, it's kind of like, this is 2004, so it's kind of, you know, there were forums and stuff, but they were all made by the companies like our one was. And, you know, we would answer people's questions online. You know, the team, we had about four staff. And you know, people would be saying that they had bugs, and we'd be, you know, talking backwards and forwards, and it was just kind of like a community that started to build up,
right?
And people started to realize that Scratch Live was rock solid, and the other piece of software had a lot of issues. You know, people were having a lot of problems with it. So,
and also, I mean, I think, you know, I think because of that grassroots beginning, right? Like, hey, we are talking to the people who created it versus a customer service rep, right?
Yeah,
I think that's kind of like the beginnings of where we are now. Like, people are used to Twitter, for instance, speaking directly to, you know, shout out to Vmota for these headphones. I posted it on Twitter yesterday that, you know, they gave me some custom headphones, and somebody immediately tweeted back like, hey, I think one of my speakers is blown. Can you guys fix it? And I'm like, first of all, I'm not in this. Secondly, but you know, that idea of access kind of helps build community. And how did you guys continue to do that? Because I feel like this is like a brand that people feel very much an affinity and a closeness to.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, we always try to be close to our customers, and that forum that we built back then is still alive today. It's actually really busy. Do you use it?
I do not. No. I have no DJ skills whatsoever. I emceed for a while. I had a DJ company, and We did a month in Jamaica for spring break.
Cool.
How about that?
That is cool.
2003, though. So.
All right.
It's yeah. Like right when you guys were first launched.
Yeah, yeah. Still... yeah, no. So, you know, obviously we're on social media and Twitter and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we try to listen to what people are saying. Often it's a lot of different things all at once. So we have right. to, you know, try and figure out what it is that we can do for people. But, yeah, it's always for us been about what the people want.
So let's fast forward a little bit because that actually leads me in another direction. Pyro.
Yeah.
Tell us what Pyro is, AJ.
Pyro. Well, Pyro is the latest thing from Serato. It's our consumer music player, but it's a music player not like anything else that's out there right now because it draws on our, you know, 18 years of experience in building software and uses the technology that we launched the company with, the time stretching plugin, and it also uses all of our song analysis stuff that we got from our Pro DJ software. So it analyzes the beats and all that kind of stuff, and it lets you choose a bunch of music and it'll mix the songs from one to the other for you.
I mean, that's pretty, and I've seen a demo, and it is like it's pretty amazing. And I was just telling somebody the story of Genuine's Pony, which is you know, it's probably I get a feeling it might be your go-to demo song.
I've used it a couple of times,
and it was just like, you know, you kept pressing along the track, and it was beat matching, right? Like there was no skip or how much of I don't know, from a design thinking standpoint, right? Like, what consumer pain points did you go like, hey, there's Spotify and there's Pandora and there's iTunes, but we need to do this?
Well, you know, I was really trying to address my own pain points. And that is, you know, when you've got friends over and you want to play some music and you don't necessarily have time to sit there on your phone or whatever and choose every song. I just wanted it to be really an easy experience, and I also wanted it to be seamless and uninterrupted. So the DJ mixing side of it was obvious, obviously, because we're Serato and, you know, we specialize in that kind of thing. But then the way that you playlist the music was probably the most important feature for me. It's like being able to just throw a whole lot of songs in, maybe choose more than one playlist, merge them, you know, shuffle them around.
Right.
And not have the music stop when you want to change from one playlist to another. You know, you can delete the entire playlist that you're about to play while a song is playing.
My pain point is like I'm always running over to the thing because I'm like, oh, this is long last song in the mix, and I go like run and I'm too late and there's like this lull of silence in the party.
Yeah, and so it solves that in a couple of different ways. Like one, if what you've chosen runs out, it just chooses more songs that go with those ones. So it never goes to silent. While you're switching from one playlist to another or inserting a song that you wanted to hear right now and still want to carry on playing the other playlist you were playing, it still never interrupts, you know?
That's great. You know, there's twice first it was Steve's story about like, hey, I want to learn this bass riff. Yeah. And it was like, and then it was you was like, I hate, like, it's interesting that, I think from an entrepreneurial standpoint where you spot your own, like, I think we are good at pointing out like things we are uncomfortable with. It's another thing to start a business behind them.
Yeah.
Right. you know,
only crazy people do that.
and I mean, what goes into that decision? Like what went into the process of like, we are going to launch Pyro, right? What was that thought process? Cause it could have been just like, I hate doing this. And 30 parties later, you're doing the same thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously now at that point, I'm already like 15 years into owning a music software company, so it's not like it's I have to start a whole company to do it. So,
right.
The decision making process around that is, you know, you see some pain points, you see a gap in the market, and you see a way that you can fill it uniquely, like no one else can, and it's just like, yeah, we have to do this.
So it launched what earlier this year?
Yeah, it went worldwide in February.
Okay. And I was looking through iTunes is how I fast forwarded in the conversation, because I think when you get feedback, right, there's one thing where you're going B2B, right? You're going from your company to DJs who are providing music for an audience. Hmm. It's another thing, like me as Joe consumer, and I go like, this is bullshit, like whatever, pardon me. my daughter's here, everybody. So now I just swore, whatever. But no, that idea of consumer feedback, trolling, like all, and I think that decision making process of like what bugs or pain points do we address and what are kind of like unaddressable.
Yeah.
What's that like? Is there a difference?
Well, you know what? Over the years that our user base has expanded more in that kind of consumer direction as DJing has become a thing that like everyone's doing. So we are already seeing, you know, the sort of trolley type behavior that you see in YouTube and everywhere else with, I guess, our customers who are, unhappy with this, that, or the other thing. But definitely, I think to answer your question, going from a pro product to a consumer product is a big step in, like, first of all, numbers of people.
Right.
And, you know, obviously also the level at which they're going to be participating with your software. So, you know, we're now, there's a lot of casual users who are going to be able to kind of look at it for 2 seconds and say, oh, this is crap, you know.
I think the other cool parallel, well, hopefully they won't say it's crap. I like it. But, you know, I think the other parallel is also that you've made two agnostic platforms, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Serato works with multiple hardware manufacturers, as does Pyro work with the Spotify's and the other music playing platforms. Can you, you know, explain that democratization strategy? Because I think some people like, hey, we made this thing, you need to buy this thing also in order to make it work. And we want it all, we want all the activity and the traffic and the data on our platform versus like, hey, let's be everybody's friend.
We like to work with people, you know. For us, the idea of concentrating on what you're good at and letting other companies concentrate on what they're good at, I think just makes good sense. You know, we don't make hardware, so it makes sense for us to have 10 different DJ hardware manufacturers. And, you know, yeah, we could, like, get a whole lot of funding and, like, try and start our own music service. But at the same time, Spotify is already there, you know, and iTunes is already there. It just makes sense to work with other people.
Have you, I guess, since in the last couple of months, have you started to get any like data from, you know, what people are doing on the platform? Do you guys monitor like, hey, this button gets clicked the most, or this function is used the most? Like, what are you learning about the consumer?
Yeah. I mean, you can do that a little bit.
Right.
The more customers you have, the more data that produces. If you try and like track every button push and that kind of thing, it's a monster amount of data. So, you know, we try to make sure that we know which screens are popular, and we need to know things like how big people's music libraries are and that kind of thing, so that we can plan our future features. But
it's also like, I hate when you ask somebody like, hey, what kind of music do you like, and they go, everything. It was like, what do you play? Like, you know, it's like, no, I listen to everything. Like, no, you don't. Like, nobody listens to everything. But when you talk about like these giant music libraries, you know, some people do have that, like that mashup culture. Does Pyro account for, you know, diverse music tastes, right?
Like, yeah, definitely. And, you know, to answer your question before about what, you know, what are we seeing? Well, people are either, you know, just letting it play and letting it just choose the music and you know, leaning right back, or they're pushing next a lot. One of the two. And, you know, it's kind of fun pushing next on Pyro because it does a mix.
It's like a toy at that point. Yeah. You just kind of like, you want to see what happens.
Well, yeah, especially when you first get it, it's like, oh, well, I wonder what it's going to sound like mixing this song into this song. And so you spend the whole time, you know, doing mixes.
Do people like, I don't know. I think there was a thing when the record industry first launched and bands were thinking like, oh no, our career is over. They can play our music anywhere. And then lo and behold, the music industry or the record industry was the thing that saved them, right? More people became rock stars and superstars. In both scenarios, I think there's always a Serato and Pyro, that there's a fear that the industry is changing too much. You're giving a little bit too much power to the, I'll say, the new generation in quotation marks.
Sure. Well, you know, I think that Serato DJ or Scratch Live, when it was first came out, it did what technology always does, and it makes it more accessible to more people. And personally, I like that. I like when technology makes it possible for people who wouldn't have been able to get into something, get into it. Because, you know, for many years, becoming a DJ was a huge commitment. You know, the building up the catalog of music and all that kind of stuff itself was a huge, you know, thing you had to do before you could, you know, be a serious DJ. And then stuff like our software came along, and it was all of a sudden people could get all the music they wanted in front of them and have it on vinyl. So, the reason I like that is because, yeah, it does open the door for a whole lot more people who maybe are mediocre, but you also get some genius that never would have been discovered.
Right.
And so that's what I like about it. And, you know, I think in some ways that Pyro kind of raises the bar for DJing a little bit rather than lowering it, because if a consumer app can mix reasonably well, then to become an actual DJ, you're probably going to have to be a little bit better than just a you know, an algorithm that is mixing two things together. So in some ways, you know, the kind of bedroom tire kicking DJ who's only going to look at it for 3 months or so, maybe, you know,
right,
isn't going to do it that much.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's kind of like a principle of disruption, right? Is it not only changes the way things are done, but it boosts the level of quality responsibility, I'll say, right? Because, you know, I worked for the New York Film Academy for a while as their marketing director. And it was right around the time that YouTube was really taking off.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, it was like, oh, well, anybody can do this now. I'm a filmmaker too. And you know, you've got millions upon millions upon millions of individual channels, right? Like, here's my stuff. And, and I think it also forced real filmmakers to like, oh, we need to step our game up, right?
Yeah.
Because we don't want to lose our bread to these schmoes.
Yeah, and I really think that once you
sorry, YouTube filmmakers, I didn't mean to call you schmoes, but it's a figure of speech.
Yeah, well, that is what YouTube did to the industry, and I think that what came out of it is good, because the quality stuff still rises to the top, even though there's a lot more other.
Yeah, there's a less quality.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And so whenever this kind of stuff happens, whenever technology makes things more accessible, you get a lot more volume, but you also get a lot more high-quality stuff at the top end.
Aside from your success, why do you love technology? I mean, obviously, if you started goofing around with tech, like as a, you know, in your teens, before it was as cool as it is now, and it's still like still becoming cool. You know, what was it that drew you to it as a, I don't know, as a young AJ?
I've always been fascinated with the future and with what's possible, and you know, how things work and all of that kind of thing. I can't even remember when that began. So I spend most of my days daydreaming about the future. Like, you know, right now we're sitting here and we're talking about all this great technology that we have right now, but you know, I spend most of my time thinking about when AI is going to take over, and you know, like the, you know, how we're going to get from New York to New Zealand in, you know, 3 hours, that kind of thing. You know, like, I love thinking about all of that kind of stuff.
It won't take you 15 years to do the next thing. What I mean, what is on outside of your personal interests or your interest broadly, but like, what's the personal thing that you actually want to tackle, you know, as an entrepreneur that's future oriented?
Right. Well, I'm actually really fascinated with how people learn things and get more intelligent. And, I think a lot of people think that your intelligence level is fixed in life, and you know, there's the smart people, and then there's the average, and et cetera.
Right.
But I actually think it's an area that is under underdeveloped, you know. So I'm really fascinated in what is it going to take to find a new way of educating people. And so that doesn't sound like, you know, tech, like standard tech kind of stuff, but I've got some ideas, and I really want to look more into that.
So I can write them down and steal them. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, I think learning and also like increasing your capacity to learn, like are two, you know, kind of things that go hand in hand. Like I've been obsessed lately with brain.fm. Have you heard of this thing?
No.
So it's like you answer a few questions and then it gives you this prescriptive like meditation music. So you can say, hey, I'm on my computer. You choose the focus thing. And then it gives you a prescriptive like background music that doesn't like, it's not making you nod your head or like, oh, let me turn this up. Let's, you know, turn up. And then for relaxation, if you're about to take a nap for 15 minutes or 45 minutes, and it's semi-customizable depending on how you answer these questions about how you behave. And eventually that increases your, hopefully, your capacity in some ways to perform, to learn. We also had a guest by the name of Walter O'Brien, the show Scorpion. I don't know if you guys get that. But this guy's is a literal genius, and we almost got in a debate. I've got nervous debating a genius. but about, like, is your intelligence fixed or not? So that's interesting that could be your next venture.
Yeah, well, there's that. And then, you know, the other thing, even more immediate than that for me, is virtual reality. The way that the world is going to change in the next 12 months because of virtual reality is just fascinating to me. It's we're right on the verge. I mean, people have been talking about it since the 90s. Remember that movie, The Lawnmower Man? You remember that?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, yes. that was a weird movie, but yeah.
Yeah, well, that was when
it was ahead of its time.
Way ahead of its time. And that was like right when we were just starting to, you know, think about it, and the tech was nowhere near being there. And now the tech is finally there. And everything is all going to come out in the next few months, and then for the next 12 months, it's to me fascinating what's going to happen really, really soon with that.
Do you believe that we? This is a philosophical question, but like, do we kind of fictionalize a dystopian future, or hey, this is what people are going to do? You know, I wonder how much knowledge the filmmakers behind Lawnmower Man had. You know, to go like, oh, here we are in 2016, and it's real. And some of it is just serendipitous, like, oh my gosh, we never knew this would have existed ever.
Well, I think filmmakers, well, storytellers really rely on tension and things going wrong and that kind of stuff to tell an interesting story. You know, everything being cool and it being a wonderful utopia isn't a very interesting story.
Right.
So, you know, that's why we imagine when we look into the future, things are going badly wrong. And, you know.
Is how much AI is there currently in Pyro? Like, is that considered a low? This is me being stupid.
Sure.
But is this considered like a low grade AI because it's predictive in a sense, or is it learning as it goes?
No, there's no AI in Pyro. Okay. Yeah. It's they're simple fixed algorithms that we created ourselves. It's humanly created.
I told you I was stupid. So when I Googled you, there's a doppelganger, AJ Burdenshaw, who's listed as an actor and a producer and a filmmaker.
Uh-huh.
And I watched. I think I found a trailer for Andy.
Oh, wow. I wasn't in that one.
But tell me about that part of your... I like this duality. You got the tech side, and then you got this super creative...
Yeah, so, well, that's my creative side is acting. I'm really into it. And I've just started a production company with a good friend of mine who I started acting with. And so we've started, we've just submitted our first short film into a bunch of... festivals. We just got accepted by something in Tokyo, which is cool.
Oh, nice. Which is ironically where you first went to try to sell Serato. It's the film career, and you're I'm going back to Japan.
Try again. I don't know. There's not much to say about it. It's just a passion of mine as well.
I mean, when did that start? Was that post, you know, launching Serato? Was this like something as a kid?
Probably about 10 years ago. Yeah.
So you walk around and go like, you know what I want to do? Act.
Yeah. that is what happened. Well, you know what happened? When I turned 30, I kind of stepped away a little bit from Serato and wanted to try other things, and that was one of the things I did.
What else was on the list? What was your 30-year-old bucket list?
Mostly traveling to lots of different places.
So, nice.
Yeah. fell in love with Las Vegas.
I bet. Yeah. That's easy to fall in love with. Speaking of milestone years, yeah. You had this epic birthday party recently. Uh-huh. You and I have something in common. We both turned 40 recently.
Oh, yeah.
Not to put either of us on blast, but I just did. just retell the story a little bit, because it seemed pretty epic as far as like the level of production that went into your... You didn't think I remembered this, did you? There's articles out there about it. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, no, we just, you know, it's my 40th, so it's a milestone. We just thought, let's do it. Do it right. I had it in an old theater. So there was this theater in Auckland that used to be used for raves and dance parties in the 90s. So I knew the people kind of around my age would love to have it there. And there's not that many events in there these days, and it burned down. And so they only recently reopened it for events.
Oh, nice.
And
I thought it burned down during your birthday party. That would have been a super epic birthday.
A few years ago. And yeah, no, we just had, you know, people dancing around in fluoro monster suits, and, you know, it was a good time.
I mean, it seemed like it was a lot of theatrics. There's you had a really cool tuxedo jacket on.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, the jacket was epic. Along your lines, my birthday party was not as epic as yours, but I did spend it with Steve Aoki,
right,
which I thought was cool.
That's cool.
You know, so kudos to me. But I'd like to think of or hear about the roster of DJs that have used your product over the years and been champions of it. I read about Jazzy Jeff and, mm-hmm. you know, all these other individuals. You were in a documentary about DJ AM.
Yeah, he was a huge fan. Obviously, great DJ. Very sad to lose that guy.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
I remember the day I actually got the text. I was like, I was in Greece, and it was a bad day.
Yeah, that I got a chance to interview Matt Colon. So, you know, helped start Dexstar, and it's just like... That had to be just a painful moment for the industry, period.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But who else is on that roster of sort of...
You know? Well, you want to go right back to the beginning when we first showed the prototype at the NAMM show. A-Track was one of our very first... it's like beta tester number one, basically. So A-Track's been a huge Serato guy for a long time. You mentioned already Jazzy Jeff. He was there pretty early. Steve Aoki as well. We did an Icon series a little while ago.
What's an Icon series?
That's what we call it. It was just a series of videos.
I see.
Of, you know, some icons that, you know, in the industry. And, you know, Fatboy Slim was on there. It was a cool interview. I think that was the first one we did. You know, there's so many, like too many to name. And that my favorite part is like meeting these guys, because they're actually mostly very cool guys.
Hey, it's super cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because, you know what, DJs at heart they're geeks like me. So you've got to be someone who, you know, like to me, a geek is like somebody who spends thousands of hours working on something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the Steve Aoki story is like his diligence and the amount of content he puts out, and it's like just the deliberateness of, you know, him like, I need to document this moment. And like, that is his own version of geekdom. And I think you know, when you,
it's the cool geeks.
Exactly. Not math geeks or myth geeks. But I'm sorry. I'm going to go find, like, this is a whole new show. I'm going to launch. But I wanted to talk really quickly about, you know, just coding versus design. Because the one thing I love about Pyro is the way it looks. It's a seriously beautiful platform. I mean, even like the flame that looks like it's moving, and, you know, the color schemes, black and orange, innovation, correct?
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, just talk about that level of user experience and color schemes, and just the level of thinking that goes in on top of the functionality.
Well, it doesn't go on top of. It's the most important thing. So for us, design and user experience actually lead function. So for us, you know, we have a team, we have a UX team, user experience team that, you know, go to great pain to make sure that the product is something that's easy to use and it makes sense and it's intuitive and all that kind of thing, which is, you know, the original Scratch Live is the reason it was popular is because, you know, back then I was the whole UX team, you know, it was,
right.
That was my, yeah, my thing. And so when Pyro came along, you know, this is something that was very personally of interest to me. So the UX team grew by one for the the whole duration of that project. And, you know, we have a lot of discussions. You know, we probably, I guess our commitment to UX probably added 6 months to the pilot project because, you know, we would go, no, this isn't quite right. We've got to, you know, change this and do, you know. And then we've got a really great design team as well that we do all of our graphics and all of our video production, all that kind of stuff in-house.
How much of that is gut versus like actually tested and feedback from people in terms of the usability and the user experience?
I think, well, rather than saying gut, I would say, you know, talent. So I would say 50% and 50%, you know.
Right.
Or, you know, we do like to test stuff, but we also like to have really good, you know, smart UX people.
Awesome. As we wind down a bit,
yeah.
The show is called Innovation Crush, and I'm curious as to what is yours? Like, what's your current innovation crush? What do you see out in the world that you're like, oh my gosh, that is amazing? It can be cuisine, it can be space travel, it can be what we're talking about, the future, but, or maybe something, you know, directly related to Serato or Pyro, but just something that's out there that AJ Burdenshaw is crushing on.
I gotta say, it's the VR stuff, you know. There's this thing I've got on order, which is called the Virtuix Omni. It's like a little platform, and you strap yourself in, and you can run around inside a virtual world because it's kind of like a 360 degree treadmill.
Wow!
So I have had it on order since it was in Kickstarter.
That launched a few years ago, right?
It's still not out.
Okay, yeah, because I remember there was something like
it's like 2 years ago that they announced.
Okay, because I'm thinking there was like a right around the time Oculus Rift was announced. Like mm-hmm. there was this
yeah.
image of a guy like in a round 360 degree.
That's it.
Yeah. Oh, that's it. Okay.
Yeah. So that's coming, and I've got my Oculus Rifts on order, and
nice.
I've got two of each. So
those sold out in 15 seconds or 15 minutes at CES, which was crazy. Mm. It was like, hey, we're taking pre-orders. I'm like, okay, it's over. We had Michelle Thaler, who's the NASA director of communications, on, and she was visiting LA to see some other stuff that NASA was working on. But one of them is a VR experience where you can actually fly through the galaxy,
mm-hmm.
And you can navigate it yourself. And it's not like an artistic, you know, interpretation. It is almost to the T size and scale of being able to navigate the universe. So I think those kinds of implications are great. Plus the idea of like treating phobias and, you know, the medical implications of VR.
The level of understanding that you can get of a subject when you're like immersed in something, you know, you said with the scale of the universe, all that kind of stuff, you have no real idea of scale and that kind of thing when you're looking at a video on a screen. But
right.
when you can turn your head and look around, you know, it's such a different
experience. Yeah, you are in that world. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Last but not least,
mm.
complete this phrase for me. You ready? Deep breath. Okay. But don't worry, it won't be as bad as me bringing up your birthday party.
Innovation to me is changing the way people think about the world.
Awesome. You've done a great job at that.
Oh.
No, I mean, seriously, like I remember, you know, Serato launching and like there was wars in the streets. Like people were like, you can't use that stuff. Like it was just, but you know, to your point, it just kind of upped the level, lowered the, democratized the playing field, but also upped the level of creativity. And like, I mean, look at where EDM is now, and you know, a lot of that is kind of coming from the technological capabilities of tools like yours.
So. Yeah, I think whenever you innovate, you can't innovate unless you change someone else's idea of what's possible. Yeah,
I like to think of it as exploring the impossible. But thank you. How can people find you? You know, whether online or do you want to?
Sure. no, my Twitter is at AJ Burton Shaw.
Your dad doesn't have that one too.
No, he doesn't.
Okay.
Yeah. Burton Shaw's with two E's.
Burton, BERTENSHAW.
Well done.
Dang, I'm good. I won the spelling bee in seventh grade, by the way.
Nice.
Shout out to Mr. Regan. But anyway, thank you for joining us. Everyone, this has been another installment of Innovation Crush, and we will talk to you next time. Boom.